Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, February 5th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading Valiant State, National, and International Headlines. The first article is titled, Georgia County Fights Back on 2020 Ballot Seizure, written by Zach Anderson and Aisha Bagchi. Fulton County, Georgia, challenged the Trump administration in court February 4th over its seizure of ballots in an investigation tied to the 2020 election, a county spokesperson said. The county asked a federal court to limit the warrant to provide an opportunity for a forensic accounting of all the documents and to request they stay in Georgia, Fulton County Commissioner Marvin Arrington said. Mo Ivory, another county commissioner, said federal officials collected 700 boxes of ballots. The FBI's January 28th search at the Fulton County Elections Hub and Operations Center marked a major escalation in the administration's efforts to pursue President Donald Trump's unfounded claims that his 2020 defeat was the result of widespread voting fraud. Trump lost Georgia in that election. It also was the latest in a string of administrative actions to use the Justice Department against the president's perceived enemies or to intervene in cases where he believes he was treated unfairly. Speaking on the Don Bongino show on February 2nd, Trump again falsely claimed to have won the 2020 election and referenced the seizure of ballots. Now you're going to see something in Georgia where they were able to get, with a court order, the ballots, Trump said. You're going to see some interesting things come out. Arrington said that while he hoped to get all the records back, the horse had left the barn. On his former FBI Deputy Director's podcast, Trump also floated the possibility of nationalizing elections. His comment generated bipartisan pushback and alarmed critics worried about the fairness of future contests. States have constitutional authority over the times, places, and manner of federal elections. State and local authorities administer voting, though the Constitution gives Congress the power to make or alter election rules. Trump doubled down on those remarks February 3rd. Asked at a White House event attended by GOP lawmakers what he had meant, Trump said, I want to see elections be honest, and if a state can't run an election, I think the people behind me should do something about it. White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt had said Trump was referring to passing the SAVE Act, a voter ID bill, in his conversation with Bongino. But Trump didn't mention the SAVE Act when asked about his podcast remarks. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, quickly rejected Trump's suggestion. He told reporters that he's not in favor of federalizing elections and thinks that's a constitutional issue, The Hill reported. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, blasted Trump's podcast comments in a speech on the Senate floor, calling them outlandishly illegal. Once again, the president's talking no differently than a dictator who wants elections in America to be as legitimate as elections in countries like Venezuela, Schumer said. The next article is entitled, Maricopa County Recorder Gets a Victory, written by John Leos. The judge has ruled that Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell cannot stop County Recorder Justin Heap from retaining a lawyer with ties to the Trump administration in his lawsuit against the county's Board of Supervisors. Mitchell is planning to appeal the ruling to the Arizona Supreme Court. It's the latest salvo in a long-strained relationship between Heap and the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. In late January, a routine meeting boiled over into shouting and recriminations. Heap filed the lawsuit against the Board of Supervisors in June 2025, claiming that county officials had stripped his office of resources and duties in administering elections through an agreement negotiated by his predecessor. After the lawsuit was filed, Mitchell sent a cease and desist letter to the law firm representing Heap, America First Legal, claiming that only she had the power to appoint an attorney to represent Heap in his official capacity. America First Legal was co-founded by Stephen Miller, a senior advisor to President Trump. Miller is a Homeland Security advisor who is widely credited as the architect of Trump's immigration crackdowns across the country. He's one of Trump's closest aides and also served under Trump during his first administration. On January 30th, Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Scott Blaney found that state law did not support Mitchell's argument. The plain language of the statute governing the county attorney's powers and duties does not empower her with the authority she claims in this lawsuit, according to the ruling. Heap celebrated the decision on social media, posting to his X account, "This ruling marks the first significant victory in our ongoing effort to restore the recorder's statutory authority and ensure the honest, trustworthy, and lawful elections that the voters of Maricopa County deserve." On February 2nd, Mitchell's attorneys asked the court to pause the judgment while the case is appealed to the Arizona Supreme Court. Heap was elected to his first term as county recorder in 2024 after defeating incumbent Republican Stephen Richer in a primary election. Richer rose to national prominence after defending the county's voting processes and the results of the 2020 election. Heap, a former member of the state legislature's far-right Freedom Caucus, campaigned on bringing transparency, honesty, and security back to the county's elections office. In June 2025, Heap filed a lawsuit against the Board of Supervisors, claiming they illegally seized the power of the recorder's office to administer some election duties after negotiating an agreement with Richer before Heap took office. He asked the judge to order the board to pay for operational costs, including new equipment and staffing. Under state law, the Board of Supervisors is responsible for overseeing Election Day voting, while the county recorder oversees voter registration and early voting, but some election tasks remain in a gray area. The Board of Supervisors filed a counterclaim asking the judge to clearly define the duties of each entity in election administration. Meanwhile, the recorder's office has faced multiple scandals in the past. Meanwhile, the recorder's office has faced multiple scandals in the past year, including the mistaken distribution of 83,000 mailers telling voters they were at risk of becoming inactive in the voter rolls. After initially blaming the vendor for distributing the letter, public records showed that Heap's office signed off on the letter. The ruling is the latest chapter in the ongoing rift between the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors and Heap, which at times has spilled into public view. On January 28th, A routine budget presentation to the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors took a dramatic turn when Heap was admonished by county officials over the conduct of his office. Supervisor Steve Gallardo, the lone Democrat on the Board of Supervisors, confronted Heap over far-right conspiratorial social media posts from Heap's leadership team, some of which he said were posted during work hours. "These are the kinds of comments that disenfranchise voters," said Gallardo, who worked for the county's elections department for 14 years. "Who the hell wants to go to your office for help knowing that your leadership team is saying this type of stuff? And if you're letting them, shame on you." Heap said he never saw the posts from staffers and said his office's work is unbiased. "The truth is, what I've done in this office is make sure that every voter can feel confident in the outcome of the elections," said Heap. "I'm a little embarrassed that this personal assassination attempt dropped in a budget proposal," he said. "If you have these concerns, I would welcome you to contact my office and set up a meeting." But the Republican members of the board also criticized Heap at the meeting. When Heap claimed the board had stripped his office of power, Supervisor Thomas Galvin interrupted him to say that Heap was lying. Chair Kate Brophy McGee warned Heap that his office could not be perceived as a political arm of the far-right political party, and said she had been let down by Heap's office countless times. In a statement, Heap described the supervisor's behavior at the meeting as a juvenile temper tantrum. The Board of Supervisors did not have a response to Heap's statement, according to Communications Director Jason Berry. The next article is entitled, "Uber Verdict Could Affect 3,000 Lawsuits," written by Miguel Torres. More than 3,000 sexual assault lawsuits filed against Uber nationwide are watching for the verdict of 9 Phoenix jurors who are weighing whether the ride-hailing giant has civil liability for what happens during its rides. The federal trial, a bellwether case, centers on Jaylene Dean, who said she was raped in November 2023 by her Uber driver after requesting a ride home following a night out. She's seeking $24 million in compensatory damages and $120 million in punitive damages, which are intended to punish the company and discourage future misconduct. After a 3-week trial, attorneys for Uber and Dean argued opposing points, framing the case either as an unforeseeable act or as a preventable failure by a company that knew certain riders faced higher risks but chose not to warn them. Dean sat quietly in the courtroom as the arguments concluded February 3rd, her body steady, her eyes fixed forward. When her attorneys spoke passionately about the toll of reliving the assault, she began to tear up. Jurors were instructed to decide whether Uber was negligent if the company defectively designed its app, or if Uber was legally responsible for its driver, and whether any of that caused Dean's injuries. Dean's lawsuit is the first of 6 bellwether trials selected by the federal court overseeing the Uber passenger sexual assault litigation, known as a multi-district litigation, or MDL. These kind of cases group hundreds, sometimes thousands, of similar federal lawsuits under one judge to streamline pretrial rulings, evidence disputes, and testimony. At least 3,000 cases from across the country including California, Texas, Florida, Illinois, and New York, are part of the Uber multi-district litigation. Individual cases are later returned to their home courts. While the verdict in Dean's case will not legally bind the others, it is expected to give the parties an idea of how remaining cases may be litigated, settled, or tried. The next bellwether case is scheduled to begin April 12th in North Carolina. In closing arguments, Kim Bueno, Uber's attorney, repeatedly emphasized framing and context, a theme she echoed throughout the trial. Sexual assault, she argued, is a devastating crime, but one that remains statistically rare on Uber's platform and fundamentally unpredictable. Bueno told jurors they must focus narrowly on this driver, this rider, and this trip, not on national statistics or other lawsuits. The driver in the case, she said, had passed multiple background checks, completed safety training, accumulated thousands of rides, and maintained a near-perfect rating. She said what happened in that car that night was wrong and a violation of Uber's policies, but the assault was not foreseeable by Uber, she said. She emphasized that Uber immediately believed Dean when she reported the assault and blocked the driver within minutes. That's proof, she said, that the company takes such allegations seriously. Uber also argued it had no duty to warn riders of risks that already are open and obvious, such as traveling alone at night after drinking, but it did by highlighting those risks in safety reports. She also said Uber created tools to keep riders safe. Dean had access to those safety tools, including audio recording, but did not activate them, Bueno said. Bueno urged jurors not to decide the case based on sympathy. Uber is a company that has a whole lot of money. Why don't we just get her some? Bueno said. But if you do it that way, if you make your decision based on that natural nature to want to help someone, you are not doing your job as jurors. Dean's attorneys urged jurors to look beyond generalities and focus on what Uber knew about this ride before it ever began. They argued Uber's internal safety algorithm flagged Dean's trip as higher risk than average, yet the company sent the ride anyway without warning her, rerouting the trip, or deploying stronger safeguards. London told jurors Uber had the tools to reduce risk, but chose not to use them. When a company of this magnitude, with this power, with this responsibility, when they have the tool and they do not use it, she said, it's outrageous. It's not just negligence. It is willfully disregarding the risk of this trip with this driver, with this rider on that night. The plaintiffs also argued that Uber had warning signs about Dean's driver, pointing to a history of rule violations they said showed Uber knew or should have known he was willing to ignore company rules without consequence. During the damages portion of closing arguments, Dean's attorney, Deborah Chang, focused on what she described as the long-term consequences of the assault. This case is really a story of what happens when your worst dreams comes true and you have to live with it every day, she said. Chang told jurors the harm did not end when the ride ended, describing how trauma can reshape daily routines, personal relationships, and a sense of safety for years to come. She urged jurors not to equate outward composure with recovery. Dean's life had dramatically changed after the assault. Once on the verge of living on her own and becoming a flight attendant at age 19, she's been plagued by PTSD and lives with her parents, anxious to travel alone. Chang emphasized that the law offers monetary remedies for those losses. Not because money can undo what happened, she said, but because it is the only way the civil justice system can acknowledge pain, fear, and the lasting loss of enjoyment of life. Jurors were asked to consider not just what Dean experienced in November 2023, but what she may continue to carry with her for decades. The jurors started deliberations late February 3rd and will continue to deliberate until they have a unanimous decision or the case is declared a mistrial due to a hung jury. The next article is entitled 1,000 Protest ICE Center in Surprise, written by Elena Santa Cruz. Dozens of people told Surprise leaders that an ICE facility shouldn't exist in the suburban city, while more than 1,000 others protested outside. Arguments crossed political lines at the February 3rd council meeting, but most people who spoke said the facility would make residents and children feel unsafe, would be inhumane, would overwhelm public safety services, and urged the city council to officially oppose it. Surprise leaders repeated what they've said in recent days. They weren't aware of the federal government's plans, and it appeared there was nothing they could do about it because federal projects were not subject to local regulations. Although the city cannot regulate Homeland Security's purchase or the use of the building, the council is genuinely committed to hearing your thoughts and your concerns, said Mayor Kevin Sartor to a packed meeting hall, which police said holds about 170 people. Still, many speakers called on the council to figure out a way to intervene. Other cities in the same boat were trying, they said. The Arizona Republic first reported on January 29th that the Department of Homeland Security bought a 418,000-square-foot warehouse for over $70 million in cash off Sweetwater Avenue and Dysart Road. ICE confirmed a day later that it would be converted into a processing facility with about 1,500 beds. Nearly 1,000 people protested in Surprise on January 31st in response. They held up various poster boards, played music, and chanted as drivers consistently honked their horns in support. Dozens of people spoke to the council during 4 hours of public comment. Very few spoke in support of ICE and the facility. Outside, demonstrators held various signs that read things such as "No ICE Facility in Surprise," "Abolish ICE," "ICE Out," and "No Kings Since 1776. A Surprise police officer estimated there were over 1,000 people outside. Community members of various ages said ICE's facility would tarnish Surprise's identity as a safe and welcoming city. Some said they were disappointed in the federal government's lack of transparency. Lisa Everett, the former Republican chair of Legislative District 29, said the issue wasn't a Republican or Democrat one. She said she believed in borders, but also human decency, and that ICE's facility was going to negatively impact the community. Surprise resident Claudia Barrera said even though she was someone of Mexican heritage, born and raised in Arizona, she, like many others, lives in fear every day. Barrera called on the council to protect the Latino community, especially children, who shouldn't be worried about family separation. John Manella, a non-surprise resident who lives about 15 minutes away from City Hall, asked the council why they were allowing the federal government to house what it describes as the worst of the worst people in the city when other cities were successfully fighting back. Either they really are the worst of the worst, and you were doing a disservice to the children of Surprise by allowing them to be right next to them, or DHS is lying, Manella said. Either way, we shouldn't have a jail right here, not in my backyard. Many suggested that the council could take action instead of throwing its hands up. They could demand answers from the federal government and the creation of impact reports, various speakers said. One speaker suggested Surprise collaborate with cities like Kansas City and Oklahoma City, which were exploring ways to push back. Sartre said he wanted to meet with that speaker in the coming days. People cheered and clapped during some comments, which Sartor advised against because he didn't want others to feel intimidated, he said. Two people said they supported local law enforcement and ICE, who work hard. One said ICE has helped pick up numerous illegal aliens in other states, and he couldn't understand why people were against the upcoming facility. He said it wasn't yet known if the facility was going to hold ICE's equipment or detainees, which prompted laughter from the crowd. ICE's future facility is located at 13290 West Sweetwater Avenue, and is about the size of more than 7 football fields. It's almost two-thirds the size of the Nestle manufacturing plant near Luke Air Force Base, which brought hundreds of jobs to the area. DHS bought the land from a developer, the Rockefeller Group, on January 23rd, according to Maricopa County property records. The records also named U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Rockefeller Group, based in New York City, bought the vacant land in January 2023 for $11.7 million, according to property records. The company has properties across the nation and developed the famous Rockefeller Center in New York City. A large for sale or lease sign sat on the exterior of the warehouse on January 20th. A note was stuck on the front door saying, "Expletive ICE." The large dark interior was mostly empty, except for a small area with poster boards on easels that didn't face the windows. 3 days later, only two things were different. A new "Expletive ICE" note replaced the old one, and the sign on the building was gone. Representatives of CBRE, the commercial real estate company that was listed on the sign, did not return calls or emails. Rockefeller Group also did not respond to requests for comments. The warehouse, about 4 miles from City Hall, is situated among other industrial buildings, but is also near neighborhoods, grocery stores, restaurants, entertainment venues, and schools. Before the meeting ended around 11:15 p.m., Sartor thanked the crowd for their attendance and passion. "We hear you. A lot to consider. Your voice is impactful and is powerful," Sartor said. You're listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled Fountain Hills Votes on Public Comment, written by Lauren DeYoung. Fountain Hills residents will again be able to speak to their council, but the power comes with a few guardrails, as one resident put it. The council voted 5-2 to reinstate public comment, with council members Brenda Kalabanyakis and Peggy McMahon voting no. The pair also voted against the majority of the council when the council voted to remove public comment in November. The vote occurred with little reaction from the sparse crowd, despite a previously contentious and at times testy meeting in which dozens packed the council chambers in protest of the removal of public comment. The return of public comment comes with a few asterisks. The call to the public was moved near the end of the meeting and will now be limited to 30 minutes, no matter the number of speakers who sign up to speak. Each speaker will get 3 minutes, the same as before. Every resident who spoke at the February 3rd meeting said they supported restoring public comment, but they differed on whether they supported the new guardrails, as resident Shelley Becker put it. "Many of us have something to say," he said. "Regardless if you agree with this or not, we should be allowed to be heard with the guardrails." But other residents were concerned, said guardrails limited the public's ability to petition their government. Councilmember McMahon worried that the new language was unconstitutional and said moving the comment period to the end undermines residents and the democratic process and discourages public participation. The town council voted to eliminate public comment in November due to the threat of a lawsuit. Residents spoke for hours in protest, even residents typically aligned with the conservative bloc of the council. "People like me are collateral damage," resident Larry Myers told the Arizona Republic on November 18th. The reinstatement comes after Fountain Hills resident Bethany Culp filed an open meeting law complaint against the town and Mayor Gary Friedel with the Arizona Attorney General's office days after the council first removed public comment. Richie Taylor, the spokesperson for the Arizona Attorney General's office, confirmed February 4th that the agency received two complaints regarding the November 18th meeting. "Both complaints are under review, but an investigation has not been formally opened," Taylor said. Culp said she would submit an additional open meeting law complaint that would supplement her original complaint. Residents who wish to participate in public comment must fill out a request to comment card and turn them in to the town clerk before the meeting begins. It also limits public comment during call to the public to 30 minutes and limits public comment on agenda items to 30 minutes. However, the mayor may grant more time for comment on agenda items. The updated rules direct residents who were not able to speak to email the mayor and council. The rules also add that the mayor has the ability to limit the number of speakers or reduce the amount allotted for public comment to allow the meeting to end in a timely manner, a power that is typical for the mayor. "We're not recreating the wheel here," council member Hannah Larrabee said, citing similarities to Scottsdale's public comment rules. Other changes to the rules of procedure include limiting council members' remarks on an agenda item to 2 minutes at a time, banning unauthorized demonstrations or disruptive outbursts like applause or any sound or action that disrupts the meeting based on the determination of the presiding officer, usually the mayor, alternating between comments that are for or against certain agenda items, and restricting the use of face coverings aside from a properly fitted medical-grade mask, respirator, or other medical equipment, or for a religious reason, part of a wearer's core tenet of faith and part of the wearer's consistent public appearance, such as burqas or hijabs. Town Attorney Jennifer Wright recommended the temporary suspension of public comment after Culp threatened to sue the town after the mayor and council allowed what she described as religious proselytizing during a public meeting. She said the complaint after the town's meeting in the wake of the assassination of conservative leader Charlie Kirk, where council members and members of the public discussed their faith in God, prayed, and criticized the political left. On November 18th, after hours of commentary, the city council voted 5-2 to permanently eliminate public comment, a first for municipalities in Metro Phoenix. The council initially considered a motion to temporarily suspend public comment for 6 months. Other cities across the valley have increasingly changed policies around public comment. In December, Scottsdale similarly moved public comment near the end of the meeting, but increased the number of speakers from 10 to 12. In 2024, Glendale sought to cut the cameras during public comment, but reversed after in-council intense backlash. Leaders did not make it entirely clear why they restored public comment 3 months after eliminating it, a shorter period than the proposed 6-month suspension. Mayor Friedel remarked at a January 20th work session that the urgency is because the constituents in this town want the call to the public brought back. That's part of the urgency. But some suspected the council brought it back in order to appease the Attorney General amidst the open meeting law investigation. Culp's complaint alleged that after a spat with Kalavanyakis during the November 18th meeting, Friedel cleared the room but did not allow all residents back in the room. Councilmember Gail Earle said a committee involving her, Councilmember Rick Watts, and Larrabee was formed in order to review bringing back public comment. It's unclear when this committee was formed or what was discussed in those meetings. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, U.S. Judge Restricts ICE Actions in Oregon, written by Michael Loria. A judge in Oregon on February 3rd put sweeping restrictions on the kinds of actions federal agents deployed in Portland can take against protesters exercising their rights to free speech and nonviolent protest. Homeland Security agents have engaged in an escalating pattern of unnecessary, excessive, and indiscriminate violence against protesters, U.S. District Judge Michael Simon wrote. The judge issued restrictions that include barring agents from using chemical irritants. The judge made the comment after a request for a restraining order was filed in connection with a lawsuit filed by the ACLU of Oregon on behalf of local protesters. In a well-functioning constitutional democratic republic, free speech, courageous news gathering, and nonviolent protest are all permitted, respected, and even celebrated. In an authoritarian regime, that is not the case, Simon wrote in issuing his ruling. He added, "Our nation is now at a crossroads. We have been here before and have previously returned to the right path, notwithstanding an occasional detour. In helping our nation find its constitutional compass, an impartial and independent judiciary operating under the rule of law has a responsibility that it may not shirk. For that reason, and as more fully explained below, the court grants plaintiff's motion for a temporary restraining order." The temporary restraining order applies to agents' conduct outside the U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement Building in Portland. The site south of the city's downtown area has been a hotbed for protests for months, and especially after federal officers fatally shot two U.S. citizens in Minnesota and shot and wounded two Venezuelan immigrants in Portland. According to the order, agents outside the facility cannot use riot control weapons unless facing an imminent threat, arrest people unless the person is suspected of committing a crime, and cannot use firearms unless legally justified in using deadly force. The order also notes that protesters ignoring dispersal orders or trespassing on federal property is not appropriate justification for agents to deploy riot control weapons. Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin, in a statement responding to the ruling, described the people outside the order protects as rioters and terrorists. "The First Amendment protects speech and peaceful assembly, not rioting," McLaughlin said. "Rioters and terrorists have assaulted law enforcement, launched fireworks at them, slashed the tires of their vehicles, and vandalized federal property. Others have chosen to ignore commands and have attempted to impede law enforcement operations and use their vehicles as weapons against our officers. Despite these grave threats and dangerous situations, our law enforcement has followed their training and used the minimum amount of force necessary to protect themselves, the public, and federal property." The next article is entitled, "Lawmakers Turn Focus to Reform Trump's ICE," written by Zachary Shermerly. The latest government shutdown is over, and Capitol Hill is already bracing for another high-profile brawl over President Donald Trump's immigration enforcement efforts that could land one federal agency with a shutdown all its own. As Trump signed legislation February 3rd to end the partial funding lapse, all eyes in Congress turned toward ongoing negotiations to reform the Department of Homeland Security in the wake of Alex Pretty's killing last month in Minnesota. In hopes of quickly slapping more guardrails on ICE and Border Patrol, Democrats initially pushed for a tight turnaround on talks with the GOP and Trump administration. But Republicans are casting doubt on whether fast-tracking the negotiations will be feasible. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, said before the shutdown ended that the timeline for solving bipartisan concerns with DHS's recent operations was way too short to allow anything consequential to happen. Ultimately, that's going to be a conversation between the President of the United States and the Democrats here in the Senate, he told reporters on February 3rd. But widespread backlash to the federal shootings last month of two Minnesotans by federal agents during an immigration enforcement surge in Minneapolis enraged the Democrats' base, angered the gun lobby, and prompted unusually harsh criticism of the Trump administration from congressional Republicans. Those dynamics gave Democrats a rare upper hand, even though they chanced another prolonged shutdown to play it. Lawmakers now have until February 13th to figure out a path forward or risk a funding lapse for just the Department of Homeland Security. That scenario will put Democrats in an awkward position, since ICE will continue operating while other important government functions that Americans rely on, including the Transportation and Security Administration and U.S. Coast Guard, experience lapsed paychecks for their staff and other disruptions. Congress approved $75 billion for ICE over the next several years under the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act that President Trump signed into law last summer. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said, "As long as Republicans negotiate in good faith, we can get it done." Senator Katie Britt, Republican of Alabama, will lead the discussions with her Democratic counterparts. Senate Democrats have a list of three main demands for reforming immigration enforcement: an end to sweeping immigration checks known as roving patrols, more accountability for ICE and Border Patrol, including independent investigations and stricter use of force standards, and a prohibition on federal officials wearing masks, along with body camera requirements. On February 2nd, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem ordered her officers in the field in Minneapolis to begin wearing body cameras immediately. But House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, has ruled out any proposal that forces federal agents to remove their masks en masse. Doing so, he argued, would jeopardize officers' safety. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat of New Jersey, said he won't vote for any DHS funding bill unless it includes radical change. I heard Johnson say things like he wouldn't even consider doing what every other law enforcement agency in America does, which is not masking, he said. That's not something that they're even willing to entertain. The next article is entitled, "Hegseth Visits Bezos and Musk Facilities," written by Sibel Mails Osterman. Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth traveled to one of Jeff Bezos's space facilities in Florida on February 2nd, as the military awards contracts to the owner of Blue Origin and other tech billionaires who have worked to burnish a chummy relationship with the Trump administration. Hegseth's visit was part of his campaign to reform the Pentagon's relationship with the defense industrial base, its system for handing out contracts to build weapons. "We will unleash our companies, unleash industry, unleash the competitive spirit that allows America to come out on top," Hegseth told the crowd. Bezos's Blue Origin has become famous for offering pay-to-ride trips to space for ultra-wealthy customers. But the company has also received billions of dollars in defense contracts to build high-tech projects such as a nuclear-powered spacecraft, communication technology that uses space lasers, and a processing facility for satellites. The Pentagon of Blue Origin did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Hegseth also made a January 12th stop at a Texas facility of SpaceX, owned by billionaire Elon Musk, who has played an even larger role in the Trump administration as its former head of the Department of Government Efficiency. At Musk's direction, Doge took an axe to the federal government early last year, wiping out thousands of jobs and entire agencies. "We want to have epic, futuristic spaceships with lots of people in them traveling to places we've never been to before," Musk said as he introduced Hegseth on stage. "That's the goal, and that's what I think the public thinks when they think of Space Force," he added, touting the military's space-focused branch. During the visit, Hegseth also announced that Grok, the chatbot run by Musk-owned social media platform X, would be integrated into internal Pentagon systems. The AI chatbot has been embroiled in ongoing controversy over its generation of sexualized images of children on X. Bezos and Musk, who both stand to profit handsomely from contracts worth billions of dollars, are among the tech tycoons who sidled up to Trump after he was elected to a second term. Both billionaires reportedly rushed to Mar-a-Lago to dine with Trump weeks before his inauguration, and Amazon, which Bezos founded, donated $1 million to Trump's inaugural fund. After news outlets reported in April 2025 that Amazon would display the additional cost that Trump's tariffs added to prices on its site, Trump called Bezos, and Amazon quickly backed down. Greg Williams, director of the Project on Government Oversight Center for Defense Information, said the conflict of interest concerns precipitated by Hegseth's speeches at SpaceX and Blue Origin were not particularly novel, and that the risk of corruption in the Pentagon's dealings with defense contractors was structural and unavoidable. But his presence is calling attention to a situation of unprecedented conflict of interest in the Trump administration. Trump and his officials have come under continual scrutiny over their refusal to divest from for-profit companies and lucrative backdoor deals with foreign officials. The Wall Street Journal reported that Emirati officials bought a large stake in Trump's cryptocurrency company shortly before the administration granted the United Arab Emirates coveted American AI chips. In the Pentagon, many individual stakeholders and private entities are cultivating personal relationships with the president while they seek government contracts, Williams said. Amazon bought the rights to Melania, the documentary about First Lady Melania Trump, for $40 million, making it the most expensive documentary in history. Of that amount, $35 million was spent on promotion for the film, raising questions about whether the hefty sum was an attempt by Bezos and his company to curry favor with the president. By spending a tiny amount of money to buy the rights to the Melania documentary, Bezos potentially gets a much larger return, in the form of Blue Origin's billions of dollars in defense contracts and other possible government windfalls, Williams said. Musk's SpaceX will see even more money pour in from defense contracts this year. 3 days after Hegseth's visit to SpaceX, the Military Space Systems Command announced it had awarded the company another $739 million for missile warning and tracking systems. The company had already clinched the vast majority of launch contracts from the Space Force for 2026. It won a $5.9 billion contract in April for Space Force launches through 2029. Blue Origin won $2.3 billion in the same tranche. Musk's companies have been bolstered by around $38 billion in government contracts and subsidies, according to the Washington Post. The full scope of Bezos's and Musk's defense contracts is unknown, since some of the details are classified. As Musk's aides fired thousands of workers and seized Americans' sensitive personal data last year, Hegseth welcomed Doge to the Pentagon to continue its stated mission of cutting wasteful spending. Nevertheless, the total savings from that effort came to just $6 billion in this year's defense budget. By comparison, this fiscal year's defense budget is an unprecedented $1 trillion, and Trump said he would ask for $1.5 trillion for next year. The next article is titled, Israeli Strikes Kill 23 in Gaza, according to health officials. Written by Dawood Abu Alkas, Nidal Al-Mughrabi, and Pesha Magid. Israeli tank shelling and airstrikes killed 23 Palestinians, including 7 children, in Gaza on February 4th, health officials said, the latest violence to undermine a truce in the enclave. Among the dead was a medic who rushed to help victims of a strike in the southern city of Khan Yunis and was then killed by a second attack on the same location, health officials said. Other strikes hit Gaza City in the north, where health officials said a 5-month-old boy was killed. The attacks came 3 days after Israel reopened Gaza's main border crossing with Egypt, a major step in the U.S.-backed truce. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.